Here we are, week five, and we're really beginning to explore what I think everybody in this room will have experience of, that whole concept of mass media. A phrase that was really coined in the 20th century by a number of theorists and still continues to equally confuse, bamboozle, vex, and otherwise impact on the daily lives of citizens in the 21st century. One of the gentlemen I'm going to be talking about today is somebody called Jürgen Habermas, who I teased ahead at the end of the session on Thursday. Hi. And Habermas is 90 years of age, still just about hanging on in there. And he was very much one of the key folk in the 1950s who worked with the Frankfurt School. The Frankfurt School was a collection of scholars in Frankfurt, surprisingly enough, who probably took a more theoretical approach to mass media in terms of its effects and its structures and so on. It's interesting in terms of Edward Bernays, who's often regarded as one of the fathers of modern public relations. Bernays was actually the nephew of somebody else you might have heard called Sigmund Freud. Bernays, probably not quite as well known generally as Freud, but at the same time certainly key to actually applying some of his uncle's psychological theories in terms of the way he would persuade people to do things and so on and so forth. And we'll talk about that again in the fullness of time. But mass media and the public. Well, as we talked about this in the early parts of Communications Society, the way in which people have communicated has moved from orality to print, combination of both, etc. Last week, arguably, was the first time I introduced you to a mass medium form other than print, and of course it was the radio. But, as I said, one of the key things I'm going to be looking at today in the sort of three major topics we're addressing will be what Habermas refers to as this public sphere. Something that you'll hear again and again throughout your time at the University of Lincoln, certainly within the modules that we come across. And then we'll look at some of Thompson's work in terms of mass media or mass communications characteristics, John Thompson, who actually is not 100% behind Habermas, but then that's what we expect. When you've got academics, they're not going to agree on everything. Habermas himself actually left the Frankfurt School and went off and produced a text in 1961, which wasn't really translated into English until 1981, so it's 20 years. But since then, it's kind of really continually resonated in terms of its impact, etc. And then we'll kind of go back in time slightly to the aftermath of World War II and the onset of genuine mass communications in PR, the two-step flow model of Katz and Lazarsfeld. So it's going to be sort of three key theories that we'll look at today. If there's time, I'll take you back even further to some of the other sort of ways and founding fathers of mass communications. If not, I'll address that on Thursday. So there he is then, Jürgen Habermas, who in 2007 was named by the Times Higher Educational Supplement as one of the ninth most popular cited academics by scholars in the social sciences and indeed in the humanities. So he crosses over in terms of English, journalism, and certainly sociology and business and areas from that point of view. He's still pretty high up there. And as I say, he tends to be cited quite frequently when we talk about this thing called the public sphere. And again, we need to sort of talk about what is it, etc. His text that I was talking about, which was originally written in 1961, and I won't give you the original German translation, but its English translation 20 years later was The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere. And in one sense, Habermas would probably argue that we have the technology now to actually make the public sphere very much viable and vital for everybody in society. It's a very democratic approach that he's taking. He really wants to ensure that there is a space to debate a whole range of issues, whether they be issues relating to matters of politics, issues related to matters of sport, issues related to campaigns, all sorts of things, should kind of, according to Habermas, have this chance to actually say, who is for them, who is against them, etc. And more to the point, they should not but just be the result of people taking sides, i.e. polarising groups, but they should be at the heart of informed discussion, informed debate. Now, straight away you might think, hang on, have you looked at some of the, have your says on BBC, or have you looked at some of the trolling on social media? I'm doing a piece of BBC Humberside in about 2 hours from now, where I've been asked to actually comment on the media and the impact on Caroline Flack. And obviously we know, presumably Caroline Flack, sadly, took her own life. Initially, I mean, speculation, obviously, as a result of pressures of social media and other aspects as well. I mean, certainly one of her colleagues on Radio 5 Live actually went very public and said that that was quite clearly what was the case, which is it's more than unfortunate, it's a tragedy. But at the same time, it's not an exclusive tragedy. So I think, you know, taking that in mind, you've also got to bear in mind the notion that what Habermas is asking for is an ideal, that people respect others' opinions and at the same time will engage in informed dialogue and discussion and debate. And in a real sense, there is that opportunity to do so, but in another sense, you can use anonymity to troll folk and so on and so forth. So there's a whole range of things there which we'll come on to discuss, etc. Why did he actually come up with this? Why was he actually so set on this? Well, as I kind of mentioned, his father was a key member and follower of the Nazi Party in the 1930s. He himself became a member of the Hitler Youth. He also actually had a cleft palate. He had two operations as a child, and it's often said that that was something which kind of impacted in terms of his personality, etc. But also there is that sense in the aftermath of World War II, and even actually during World War II, in terms of how could a whole country effectively believe what they were being told? Why was there no indication that somebody said, excuse me, I think you're wrong to say that gypsies, Jews, Catholics and other folks should actually be taken off as a final solution and exterminated. Maybe it's not an answer to our problems, etc., etc. You know, a whole range of issues with respect to that, which, in retrospect, are really shocking aspects. And it's that whole notion of do you take time to reflect on what's been happening, what's going on? Germany's not alone in this. I don't think there's a single country in the Western world that actually is immune from problems related to this, Britain included, where there are issues in terms of how things have been developed. And again, even in Africa, we had at the end of the 20th century, the Tutsi rebels and a whole range of other aspects going on there. So there are huge challenges that are actually based here. But nevertheless, from a public's point of view, how does that relate, how does that work through, is at the heart of this. And ultimately, what Habermas talks about are two key areas that he would say are at the heart of what he would be regarding as the public sphere. In other words, a place where people can engage in discussion about aspects. This is pre-internet, obviously, when he's writing this, pre-web, pre-social media, etc. Number one, you've actually got critical journals and, as he refers to them, moral weeklies. Journals which will actually take a particular specific point, whether it be Marxism Today, whether it be The New Statesman, whether it be New Society, any of the kind of critical journals which will actually have a particular viewpoint, The Tablet probably be another case of that, which would again comment on other aspects. His second phenomenon, which wasn't really new, because actually the coffee houses and the salons, the precursors to Starbucks, kind of emerged in the 18th century as a very popular place when the increasingly affluent merchant class, the people who were investing in ships to go and explore other lands and trade with other lands and so on, were at the heart of this. And they needed to actually have a place to talk about their material, find out information. It's where we see certainly the establishment of the first major insurance companies like Lloyd's of London, insuring ships against sea storms, piracy, all sorts of other issues with respect to that. So you're gradually getting a sort of shift in terms of the culture that we appreciate the other day. Remember, this is all 300 years or so after Gutenberg had put the printing press in place. That was working. We had 300 years of print. Print was by now established. It was a regular mass medium. And there was an opportunity in which information was being shared to actually talk about the kind of key things that were being discussed and so on. So In other words, you've got two things. You've got the written word, which is information for public consumption. You know, you read, you learn about stuff, you take different pieces of opinion, you get that. And you also get orality, different places, I mean, you know, salons, public houses, and so on and so forth, where you'll actually talk about things. Now, you could say, doesn't that really lead to gossip? And you'd be absolutely right. The same way, you can have challenges. But basically, the equivalence between those two effectively leads to what Habermas refers to as the public sphere. Because it's something which isn't personal, and this notion of privacy, this notion of kind of ensuring that we have our own particular viewpoint on life is relatively recent. You know, again, the sort of notion of having a sort of an openness, etc. Offenblech is one of the words that he actually sort of uses for that. But it kind of encroaches into that. Put even more simply, we used to have a situation whereby society was pretty much divided into two major parts. We had the first estate, which would be primarily the rulers, usually the kings and emperors of a particular society, and probably the church. Certainly in cases of everything after the year 300, or about, which was pretty much when the Christian church started becoming established and based within its own sort of self, apart from the schism that was due to take place between East and West. But you'd have the state very much as the number one oriented thing, with the church pretty much there. So God, the state, and the servants, or the peasants, or the serfs. There wouldn't be room for a middle class. That would not have existed. So we get that notion of the first estate and the second estate, and then gradually we get a third estate evolving, which is a middle class. A middle class of people who kind of, they're not serfs. They've got a certain amount of freedom, but they're certainly not the super rich. They're not the kind of, they're not the deal makers and decision makers. Maybe growing to that point of view. And this is basically where Habermas starts talking about the state, and the relationship between the state and the individual can really only be discussed via that lozenge in the middle there, this public sphere. This is where we get the first leanings of what, one of the reasons in terms of why the press is referred to as the fourth estate. Because the press is established to scrutinise what's going on by the leaders of society, what decisions they're actually making with the taxes that they're taking from the rest of society. Because obviously, you know, the only way in which the state can maintain its power is by ensuring that, you know, they take money from everybody else. And that can be obviously through legal taxes and the taxation, and it can open up a whole range of things. I mean, again, you've got a whole variety of things there, which are, again, I'll show you, which at one level go to the Boston Tea Party and Thomas Paine and Rights of Man, and the Declaration of Independence, and so on and so forth. Because all sorts of things can be said in terms of that. Also France, that whole notion of the revolution that took place in France and led to, obviously, ultimately, the Napoleonic Wars, etc. Very much at the heart of how these things have been developed and taken. Habermas argues for this little term called the re-feudalisation of the public sphere. And this is looking at what we get in the 20th century and the 21st century. Feudal, actually, as a term, comes out of that kind of medieval term of where you have the kings and the emperors and the church and the serfs or the peasants. But he actually argues that what we've got is a new development here, insofar as what you've got in a commercialised world is a world in which far too often all you get is surface and no substance. You scratch the surface, you get more surface. It's all about the image. It's all about the sales pitch. It's all about consumerism. Big shift in America in the 20th century towards consumerism. And the whole philosophy of consumerism is actually based on the philosophy that you buy stuff to make you happy. And if you're not happy, buy some more stuff, and that'll make you feel more happier. If you're not feeling, and so on and so forth. There is that challenge of always kind of saying, there's something, there's a need you need to be fulfilled, there's a problem that you've got to solve, there's a need you need to fulfil, and so on and so forth. And that also can lead into product over content, and the other sort of key things, politicians who will simply make use of that to give their own political spin on manufacturing and processes, etc. It's no surprise that when Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, and Ivy Lee, who's probably best known as the father of the phrase, the truth will find you out and come back to bite you, basically, so it's best actually to maintain truthfulness at all times within public relations. There is this line that America in itself is changing its shift. It's moving. You've got Ford, Henry Ford, developing Fordism. You've got the mass manufacturing industries. But actually, on that side, even in mass manufacturing, you're still getting a new generation of the equivalents of barons, the equivalent of landowners, the equivalent of factory owners, and so on. Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, and so on and so forth, all fitting into that scheme. Not too dissimilar to actually what, in the other end of the extreme, you see in terms of communism, where again, you've got another sort of split between the dominant body and the subordinates, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's ironic if you actually look at extreme capitalism and extreme communism, they kind of meet each other. They're both the same, really, ultimately. That sort of line is actually there. But that's another line for another discussion. Now, John Thompson has a number of issues with that theory as I've laid it out there. First of all, he maintains, you don't have to establish these public forums because they already exist. People will already speak to each other. People will already connect with each other on a sort of fairly regular basis. It's not something which is going to be left out from that point of view. Also, he did say that maybe understandably, maybe because he'd had enough of his other colleagues, Max Horkheimer and Adorno, A-D-O-R-N-A-N-O, at the Habermas School, that he actually ignored less political texts. He actually ignored popular culture. And the one thing that actually really emerged of the 1930s, 40s, 50s and 60s was A, the growth of the teenager, and B, the growth, the substantial growth of the teenage consumerist market. Certainly it worked a lot better in America for a long time before it kind of reached Britain, because Britain was still having rationing for nigh on 10 years until the Second World War actually ended. So you'd actually had the war, end of the World War II in 1945, and then rationing lifted in 1954. So big issues there in terms of it took a lot of time. If you wanted to have any white goods in Britain in the 1950s, you had to put your name on a waiting list. You know, you didn't just go to the store and say, I want a refrigerator. You'd put your name on a waiting list, and then maybe 6 or 7 months down the line, you might get one, possibly, or not. Same with cars. So, you know, so that kind of instant thing did not occur. It was like the American dream was presented to British folk, but it was inaccessible until pretty much the mid to late 50s. Now you could actually argue, is that a dream or is that a nightmare? But certainly in terms of popular culture, whether you're talking about record sales, whether you're talking about the phenomenon of fashion, whether you're talking about the Beatles, Elvis Presley, etc., etc., the whole range of sort of issues there, Tamla Motown, etc., you've got a whole range of other areas within that. And also, Thompson is a bit concerned that Habermas actually says that because he's actually suggesting you need to have an educated group of people who are there, that is automatically maybe eliminating people who aren't educated. How do you define that? Where do you, you know, are you limiting it, the access that people have got to that? And also, I think Thompson takes a more optimistic view in terms of actually saying what we're seeing here is a progress. It's an evolution. It's something that actually is developing rather than actually declining. The Habermas bemoans regularly the lack of informed debate and discussion. And again, he may have a point, but he may not. This is something we'll talk about on Thursday, but something to consider, and actually today, do we still have a public sphere, or do we rather have a series of public spheres that actually it's unlikely that everybody, even around this table, is going to have the same interests? Actually, of course, it's not just enlightened, it's absolute guaranteed fact. I'd be amazed if we all had the same sort of interest from that point of view. So, you know, from that point of view alone, where do you actually take commonalities? Do you have a growth of communication subcultures? Some people are interested in one particular brand of fashion, some people aren't interested in fashion at all, some people might be interested, etc., etc. Some people might be really interested in what's going to happen to Britain post-Brexit, post-period of transition, etc. Other people really don't care. And again, that whole sort of notion that, you know, it almost anticipates that people do care, where frankly, most human beings, we basically probably aren't interested. And it's just a case of how do you engage with that? You know, when you start talking about surveys and survey, I mean, I personally find I get really tired when you actually stay in a hotel, various other things, and you have to then fill out a survey in terms of, I mean, if it was wrong, I'd fill it, but is this, you buy something on Amazon, you actually get, you actually purchase this, what do you think of this, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I might do a few, but I'm not enough already. So again, there's a debate with respect to that. And there, as I say, is Thompson himself with his kind of real development, which in his book Mass Communication in Modern Culture feeds very much into what O'Sullivan and Jukes wrote in terms of media studies. Now, media studies as an academic subject kind of began to really develop in the 1980s. Prior to that, it was kind of split between literary studies, film studies, and other sort of aspects within the humanities or social sciences. From the States, it was generally deemed that there was a need to understand how populations behaved. This is one of the reasons why frequently sociologists and psychologists and economists were brought into the field to effectively start sorting out how you could fix society. Now, this all comes from the whole notion of scientific notion, the scientific method. We've obviously seen within living memory huge progressions. You've seen from the point of view of the telegraph to the radio to films to cinema to TV. So lots of big changes technologically. The horseless carriage, the car, the airships, the airplanes. You know, lots of indications that science can really fix things. Science can actually sort of sort things through. So if science can actually fix things like travel, fix things like entertainment, etc., why can't science fix things when things maybe go a bit wrong, like they did at the Wall Street crash, or when perhaps there are different changes, etc.? And is it a case of if you number crunch, you can actually ensure that you can pretty much map out what things are going to be popular, what things aren't going to be popular, so you can almost start manipulating audiences? And this is where you start talking about how do you engage with communities, how do you develop those particular aspects. Big issues, and again, it's raising that sort of point in terms of how we address them and how we actually speak to them and so on. So let's go back to some of the key characteristics of mass communication, which again might lead on to audience manipulation. It may lead on to other sort of aspects, which again, we can use as quite interesting aspects in themselves. There is a one-word aspect which will come across again and again, almost as much as I mentioned Habermas and public sphere, and it's the phenomenon of indeterminacy, which can loosely be translated as we don't really know. There isn't one set answer all the time to everything. People will have different viewpoints. As I said, to use the recent political example, many people would actually turn around and say, yeah, Brexit good. Many people would say Brexit bad. Many people would actually say, we just don't know. Big level in terms of indeterminacy. And actually, for most things, it's rare to get 100% agreement. There's always some indication. I'm sure if I use the Caroline Flack example once again, there were people who said, well, you know, it's a third suicide to do with the show, but it's great entertainment, isn't it? I mean, push the ratings out. We'll be watching it. Some sort of, certainly back in the day of the French Revolution, most grannies would actually go out for a trip to actually sort of do some knitting and watch a few public executions. In the 19th century in Britain, going to the lunatic asylum was seen as a family day out, going to Bedlam and actually seeing the so-called lunatics actually behave in their own sort of way, etc. All of these things come into play. You know, humanity has got a very checkered history when it comes to supposed entertainment, etc. So again, issues to be had there in terms of indeterminacy, etc. But the other key thing that we're faced with today, and probably will be faced with throughout the century, unless there's a, you know, God forbid, nuclear war or end of planet extinction event, etc., is data storage. Yes, we've got more processing power in one of these devices than actually successfully sent Apollo 11 to the moon and back. And you can access a whole stack of things. You can, if you wish. You know, at this moment, It would pull up Habermas, say, oh, what's he doing? It's, you know, find out a whole range of things. There's stacks of things you can find out. But how do you actually discern the amount of information that's actually there? How do you sift through what is useful information? Is it simply a case of, well, you trust a search engine? We trust Google, obviously. Well, there are other search engines available. There's LexisNexis, the academic search engine that, you know, Serkin recommends use. There are all sorts of other areas that you can use. And also, we have moved on substantially from the days in which, from print, information was stored on sheets of paper, or scrolls, or parchment, or latterly books, and other things. And books, again, over long periods of time, will gradually decompose, unless they, you know, unless they're taken care of and looked after, etc. All sorts of print-based media will actually go. Audio-based media, likewise. We do have, through digitalisation, an access to a lot of things that otherwise we wouldn't have had, because, frankly, film stock would have just decomposed. Videotape, again, not sure how long the lifespan is for, with respect to that. And also there comes to a time where, even in terms of solid-state circuitry, in terms of disk drives and various other bits and pieces of information storage. Now, you might sort of think, oh, yes, you know, you might have 15 gigabytes of data for your Google account, and then if you approach the end of that, they'll say, would you like to take advantage of this and this and that? And there are lots of ways of monetizing areas. I don't know if you... do you ever use WeTransfer? Anybody share any audio files, etc.? I mean, WeTransfer, it's free up until you go over 2 gigabytes, and then you need to pay. Most people actually don't never translate anything more than 2 gigabytes. You just send it as zip files. Likewise, podcasts, or storage, all sorts of things. How is the storage actually accessed? How is it put together? We live in an information economy. It was often said a few years ago, the buzzword was, start of the century, we've moved on through the Industrial Revolution. We are now in the Information Revolution. Now, on the one hand, you say, yeah, okay, carry that to its extreme. I could just provide a virtual lecture. You need not even come to campus at all. You could access that online, wherever you happen to be, Bermuda, North Carolina, Hull, any of the sort of zones is actually there. Fine, you know. But does that take away from that whole notion of interconnectivity and so on? Again, we talk about new universities, new learn. I mean, universities in this case have still not, we still haven't really got our act together. We talk a lot about online economy, digital natives and so on. But it's still a case of uncertainty in terms of how far things actually go with respect to that. In other words, we are talking about commodification. And that basically means making money out of particular products. Now, as I said, education operated for a long time on the basis of education is good, it should be free for all, there's an accessibility of that, but you're still looking at who makes the textbooks, who prints the textbooks, who sells the textbooks, and so on and so forth. There's always a commodification element that comes into that. And also, in terms of mass media, you know, why is there such a concern about birds of prey just basically collapsing completely? Maybe it's because it's not a good movie. I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen it as yet. But in terms of the general line of that, if movies don't get the big numbers, they don't get that, then they're viewed as problematic. There are issues being raised with respect to that. You know, people will buy other things out. Disney has got a huge sort of input in terms of what it produces, what it controls, its intellectual property rights, and so on. But even Disney's aspect is dwarfed, as we've said, by the likes of Google and so on, in terms of what's out there. And you know, Netflix, obviously, another sort of case in point, and so on. Which brings me to that other line. How available is it? Because, again, we don't want to effectively, necessarily, have to go through that whole notion of searching for information. Days where, in order to actually search out the rationale for particular essays or stories, you'd go to the library, you'd get books from the library, you'd access that. I mean, hopefully we'll do that as a complementary sort of aspect, but there are other online ways. But equally, as we also know, not everything online is true. Using Wikipedia as an initial starting off point is okay-ish. But if you just put a whole range of Wikipedia sources down in your essay, I'll be a bit concerned because Wikipedia is not assessed as rigorously as other academic sites are. And again, before it's published, you know, anybody can publish anything on Wikipedia and claim it's true. I mean, a lot of the stuff is true, but a lot of it isn't. And then you're into that whole line of information, disinformation, and, dare I say it, fake news. You know, how do you actually sort of deal with that whole side of things? You know, Facebook say they've been introducing algorithms to combat fake news. Can they? Will they? I don't know. All these issues kind of relate to how we're sort of seeing this sort of thing. But again, because of its availability, that is another sort of key point in terms of that. There has always been fake news. There has been fake news ever since you know, people started telling tall tales about the monsters they fought against, about the mermaids and sea creatures that rescued people. Right the way through, you can see a whole tranche of fake news that's actually there. It's nothing new. The difference is when people start believing that fake news as, well, it must be true, etc., because it says so and so, so and so. So, let's talk a little bit about these two chaps there. Eli Katz and Paul Lazarsfeld. And their book, Personal Influence. And I think I've used that particular sort of image there because it kind of really shows the challenges that you got between using technology, he said, she said, developments on that basis, people shouting. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot of people trying to grab your attention. No matter what age you're at, no matter what sort of part of life, you know, it's again, whether you should be sort of, you know, prepping for that time, that's sort of, you know, lots of competing voices. And in, you know, so much additional anxiety there. I mean, the wonderful, I mean, we'll use a sort of a Habermas line, German for word Angst, which actually translates as anxiety. That angst feeling that sort of is there, FOMO, fear of missing out. And there's, oh, I don't get it, da-da-da. You know, it's not going to be the end of the world. You know, it's not, you know, to actually get to the stage of being completely locked into the fact that you physically have to ease back. Sometimes doing a digital detox is actually what's needed. Because otherwise you can. I mean, Lazarsfeld and Katz are writing this before social media or the impact, and there are other things that are coming through within that. But that whole aspect of the way in which personal influences combine, and the very term influencer, which is very much used by some pretty high earning vloggers and vloggers who will actually sort of be paid by a variety of companies to represent. Do we have any influencer followers here in fashion or people who sort of say, oh, I must access that? No, I mean, Kerry, you sort of, I thought there was that. No, nothing.
I have some friends though.
Yeah. Okay. But again, it's, you know, and, I mean, nothing necessarily wrong getting other people's opinions, but it depends how much they're sort of looking to develop in terms of their capital and so on. Katz and Lazarsfeld came up with this little aspect, and it's something that they call as the two-step flow model. Okay? And broadly speaking, this is something that you can apply to an awful lot of communications theories and elements within that, and certainly the element of mass communication. I wouldn't necessarily expect you to apply this to any of the presentations. You can do, it's not essential. It's something which kind of beds in to the course and probably comes into when you do community engagement with me on doing that, communicating in the public sphere in level two. Always like to have a chicken in there. But you can have, according to Katz and Lazarsfeld, opinion leaders. That can also degenerate into what you see there, which is a kind of version of he said, she said. You know, somebody says that there's an outbreak of coronavirus that's taken place in the engine shed. You know, how much truthful is that? How far does it actually go before you get to that whole system there? How much do you trust the source of the information? And that is, you know, where we do use the T word very solidly in terms of public relations. Trust, you know. A cynic might turn around and say the last thing you should ever do when somebody actually uses the word trust me is to do that. But when you're actually involved with this whole thing, it does boil down to, do you prefer, shall we say, the Telegraph versus the Guardian? Do you prefer the Independent? Do you prefer the Sun? You know, newspaper sort of aspects. Do you prefer ITV News, Channel 4 News? Is that biased? do you actually get into it, etc., etc.? Where do you actually get your news from? How much faith do you actually have in the news? Or would you go back to the days where literally it's just a case of, well, it's anecdotal, and it's a case of you being told on this sort of basis? That's that. One word of advice I'd always say as an academic: never, ever, ever believe anybody who claims to have all of the answers. Any academic, any individual who actually says that this is the one way is wrong. There are always alternatives, other changes. Use your own, as I say, inner bovine stuff detectors to actually sort out what's true, what isn't true, developing on that basis. You can find out more about this if you go over key concepts in communication and cultural studies. But if we're looking at what Katz and Lazarfeld are actually talking about, they broadly speak about this particular area. And the reason they call it a two-step flow model is because it's got a flow and it's got a couple of steps there. They would actually argue that we start off on this side with the whole notion of media. And media can be film, it can be television, it can be radio, it can be print, it can be a combination of all of those. That will then lead into, possibly by numbers, possibly by a whole range of things, but opinion leaders. Whether that's editorial comment, whether that's viewpoint that's being made by people, that might be, it might be religious leaders, it might be community leaders, it might be a whole range of things there, but people who basically are entrusted or have actually got a certain amount of faith in. I mean, obviously this tends to break down somewhat when you have the deliberate mendacity of the current occupants of 10 Downing Street and the White House and arguably the Kremlin as well, who seem to have difficulty with respect to the concept of the truth. I don't know, maybe it's just something they've never got used to, etc. But again, other issues with respect to that. But that could then also, in an ideal world, you would say, you would take out social content, because if you're a public relations officer or a campaign, it would basically go from media, make the thing, and that goes straight to the individuals. But life is more complicated than that, and you do get interference. Not only will people be influenced by everything from their peers, from their parents, from other things that they actually read, from social content, etc., which means that you probably get, in the second step, a number of individual understandings of that original opinion. It's inevitable. You know, it's like the number of different stories you'll get if you ask somebody to describe a particular event. Because of point of view, because of presence, of existence, etc., you'll change all those things around and develop that whole notion of the two-step flow method. Okay, briefly, sort of teasing ahead of this, I want to talk a little bit about the Fourth Estate and how this developed, because I think it's worthwhile just to get a little handle on this as well, in terms of the rise of that first mass media form of the print thing in terms of politics, the press, and the public sphere. As I say, if you want to go for the original book or his notion of Öffentlichkeit, that's the whole system. You see the translations from that point of view. And again, I've talked about that in terms of what Habermas was about. I'll give you a chance to just sort of read through that. That's pretty much what he talks about at the heart of his public sphere development. And it goes back, from Habermas' point of view, way back to the ancient Greeks. Again, fine. But they also took a blind eye on slavery. You know, I mean, the thought of a society without slaves has been inconceivable. Also, the thought of a society which actually had mechanical, physical experiments was deemed a little bit vulgar, because the best experiments, as Pythagoras and Archimedes and so on would actually argue, were thought experiments. You know, the purity of the mind, thoughts on that basis. One of the reasons why, you know, I did lots of ways in which arguably the Greeks could have developed some kind of mechanization, but they didn't, because actually there's no need to, really, because slaves do things like that. Again, think back to that original sort of line of the timeline which took us from orality through to the printing press, the 1400s, 1475, through to the 1700s, to the present day, etc. And you see this gradual growth of private trade and public discussion. that is pretty much what I talked about again in terms of Habermas from his lines of that. How did these develop? And yes, you would have smoking shots and sort of a whole range of things there, mostly masculine oriented, because obviously women wouldn't know what to do in that sort of situation. Only kidding. But you have scenarios from that point of view whereby you did have a range of what we refer to there as formalized gossip. You know, this is where you get magazines, which are still in, some of them which are still around today, like Punch. Punch ended a few years ago. The Spectator, which is still running. In fact, Boris Johnson used to write for them. And clearly, if you've got people that you can sell your publications to who want to have more information, that's how you get the growth of the press. This is where we see the first major issues of the press beginning to develop and so on in the 20th century. And then, of course, on the other side, you also get this notion that the middle class has become more and more involved with politics. So, again, that line to come across is that how do people who are contributing to society, to what extent are they enabled to engage with society? To what extent do they actually have a say in what society is actually coming out with? You know, again, these are not unique concepts. These are concepts that took a lot of time to work through. Equality, not just for women in the 1920s and the suffragette movement, but latterly in the States in the 1960s with the civil rights movements, etc. And even today, you could actually argue there are huge areas of the planet where actually there's a disenfranchisement of individuals for a number of reasons from that point of view, you know, religious, otherwise, etc. And I think that's where I kind of want to leave it at this particular stage, because although we said here that the initial stage of the public sphere tended to concentrate on commerce before it moved into taste and fashion, etc., and what we would refer to as sort of like the mass media of today, maybe that's one of the sort of zones whereby as we progress into the 21st century with the advent of social media, etc., and there's another lecture I'll be giving you sort of later on where we talk more about that, we start opening up into a different sort of zone, which may be simply more of the same. It may be, you know, we're doomed to not learn lessons of history and therefore repeat them, as Santayama once said, or indeed Fukuyama, who actually sort of once talked about the decline of the West at the end of the 20th century. Or maybe we're heading into a whole brave new world. Has anybody got any initial questions that you'd like to put to me